I wish to continue where we left off last time. Just to remind you where we were. Let's enter the conversation with something which we around this table have spoken about many months ago. Rav Kook was a totally unified personality. There were no exceptions to the rule. His beliefs, his thought systems, his patterns of solving problems were all one unity, one whole. You knew where the man stood on any and every issue once you knew the man. You will recall when we were studying Rav Kook on the Rambam, must be well over a year ago, that Rav Kook took a heavy issue with a long article of evaluation written by Rav Zev Yavitz, the Orthodox historian of the early part of the 20th century, probably one of only two who were frum people and had an ability to write history, wherein Yavitz believed that the Rambam's Mora Nevuchim and his exposition of Greek philosophy and Aristotelian thought was not vintage Rambam. It was that he was forced into it. It was a sign of the times, and they only had to justify one system of thinking some which way with another system of thinking of Torah, but that if the Rambam hadn't been forced into it, he probably would never have written it. The Rambam, the Isha Halacha, was a totally different personality. Rav Kook could not at all countenance such an idea, and goes ahead and openly refutes what Yavitz said, and Yavitz was very close to Rav Kook. Today, needless to say, in the yeshiva world, people will say, as has been said to me always, well, we don't accept everything that Yavitz writes, end quote. That's a quote. We're talking about the 13th volume, where religious nationalism starts to spurt. Yavitz himself was one of the founding forces of the so-called Mizrahi. But be that as it may, I use this only by way of anecdotal example of a Mahalach HaMachshava of Rav Kook. A personality such as a Rambam is totally unified. There are no such things as extraneous matters. And if you're forced into something, and it's not really you, you will already know it Mineyube from the very document that is produced, or the situation that gives rise. Nowhere in Rambam's Mora Nevuchim do you see that this was under duress, such as when the Ramban wrote many years later his account of the famous debate that he had in 1263 with the Christians in Barcelona. And he came up against a Meshumad, Pablo Cristiani. There he wrote for tactics and strategy. Wrote strange things. We know that because he was under duress. He was forced to debate. He was forced to write what he debated because the church completely mangled and distorted what the Ramban said, so as they coming out on the top, when he actually tzishmetat them, he decimated them with his logic, so much so that the king of that Portugal state that called it, today it's Portugal, but it was Spain at that time, the king paid the Ramban an honorarium for smattering the papal representatives. He so much enjoyed it, and told him that if you value your life, you better get out of here. And at age 70, the Ramban picked up 1263, 1264, and went to Eretz Yisrael. And that's where he completed the major contribution of his to Chumash, which was his parish on Chumash.
He did
it now, so past most of it, past the age of 70. Now there, you know exactly that the man was under duress, and this was not typical for his personality. You don't have that with the Rambam, claims Rav Kook. And much like the Rambam, Rav Kook was a totally unified personality. We began to try to draw kavim bidmut Rav Kook, to try to see characteristics of personality with Rav Kook. And we did that last time. If you want to refresh your memory, then you would have to go back to the tape of last time. It may seem to you that it is entirely, you know, it's hackneyed, you've heard the things. I maintain that this unity of personality is so critical, so as to be appreciated 50 years after his, 51 years after his death, in the hope that it can give this generation in general, and those of us who talk together over these Rosh Chodesh occasions in particular, a kind of beacon light to be able to emulate. He was entirely Torah, and even these little maisalach represent things that have to be not only studied, but digested, ingested, and internalized so as to be able to affect our behavior. Because I believe the man had the key, and not too many people had the key the way he had. For instance, a matter of perspective on page 3, the item which I have marked number 3. You may remember that at the same time that Rav Kook was the so-called chief rabbi of the Zionist machinations, the what we would call today the Frum community, the Black Hatters, had a chief rabbi of their own. An Odom Godol, a Talmid Chacham, second to none, and a Tzaddik also, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was dead set against the whole idea of a chief rabbinate, when especially it could be designed and interpreted as being an arm, a wing, playing into the hands of these rebels. Rav Kook saw the danger, but Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and a part of the community refused to even come near the danger, and there was a tremendous amount of rift between the two communities. On a personal basis, Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and Rav Kook had personal respect, and I would even say admiration, for one another. It's only when the Chassidim got a hold of things on both sides that relationships degenerated. But the point is that these two men were as far from Mizrachis to Mairo in a perspective on the generation. Masrul al-Arav, for example, they told Rav Kook in the name of Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld the following Dvar Torah, that twice in Chumash, Shtei Parmim Yesh Bakatuv, in Chumash, the word Nachnu. Nachnu is Anachnu, we, missing the Aleph, instead of Anachnu. The first time is in Bamidbar, Nachnu Na'avor Chalutzim. This is when Bnei Yisrael said, after they had their downfall, and they lost the war because of Chait, Nachnu Na'avor Chalutzim, we are now going to go ahead and become the pioneers. In other words, we're going to be the Green Berets and we're going to go. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu told them, hey, Hanukkah not to go. Ribbono Shalom doesn't want you to do it. The second time, I said Chumash, it's not in Chumash. The second time is in Eicha, after the destruction. Once again, after a downfall. Where we read in Eicha and Tisha B'Av, Nachnu Foshanu Umarina. We are the ones who have upset and revolted against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And again, both of the times, you see the same. You see the same thing. This is a parallel. Now, Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld was saying that you see, whenever Bnei Yisrael revolt against HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the establishment and the Word of God, which we are harbingers of, you're going to have a downfall. Between the lines, what he was simply saying, and he was particularly using the word chalutzim, you know, the pioneers who are coming to Eretz Yisrael, this is against Torah, the way you are doing it, and what you are doing, and you are coming to Eretz Yisrael thinking that you're rebuilding it, and you're wrong, you are destroying it, because you are not from, etc., and so forth. One perspective. When Rav Kook heard this, Omar al-Zeh Arab, Yesh od katuv echad. There happens to be one other pasuk, and it's a simple pasuk in Parshas Vayeshev. Shneim abo anachnu, kulonu bnei ish echad nachnu. Remember when the brothers stood in front of Yosef? Okay. And this was already the coming together of a broken family. This was already the mending of a tarnished destiny. Of Achtus Yisrael. And finally they're standing in front of this Egyptian prince, and they are pleading, especially Yehuda, is pleading for the welfare of all the brothers. Okay? There's one other time. Now, you see in this pasuk the sense of unity, the sense of coming together. Let me finish, then we talk. Okay? Here is my point. You will never convince me or anyone else that the Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld didn't know that third pasuk. But here is the issue. We filter out of our minds that which does not say to us what we want to have said. Okay? Because the Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was as big a baki of psukim, especially these unusual grammatical forms, as Rav Kook was. No two ways about it. And if you doubt it, then you're just off base. But to be able to say twice these two things and not a third time, okay, is a matter of selective reasoning. You will pick what you want. And Rav Kook, as in terms of personality, viewed the call of the day, the need above all else, is the coming together of Klal Yisrael. Anything that will bring us together and maintain a wall in front of the losses that were happening at that time for a century, he was ready to stand by. You will say,
I don't think that all three Nachnu is not Kulanu. Nachnu Navol Chalutzim, it was a part of the nation. Nachnu Pashanu Marinu is also a part. It does not talk for everyone, because acceptance of a Pesha, that recognition, is unusual to be for the whole nation, because some will always be tzaddikim. Nachnu Bnei Ish Echad, Yosef was missing according to them. There's still a missing one.
I think Rashi says
in the Pashanu. What Rashi? I'm not Rashi.
No, but I...
No, what do you say?
He says that they were like, it was like the Sefer, or like, you know, they didn't know what they were saying. They were including the Yosef.
I say against Rashi now. Nachnu, in that case, is Yosef was missing, according to them. That means the 12 brothers was missing. So in all three, we see Nachnu is not a Nachnu. Oh. It's Nachnu, that we are all.
The Aleph is missing.
The Aleph is missing.
Wonderful.
So actually, Chaim Zonnenfeld probably knew about this one. He simply thought with two is going to be sufficient.
Actually, I was thinking
because all three are the same.
It could very well be. There's only one problem. You are learning psukim and I am looking at personalities.
I was thinking the opposite.
That's the issue.
I was thinking the opposite.
No.
Because I mean, what Rashi is saying, here they're standing before a Jew who is in the role of the government, but who looks like a non-Jew, right?
Right.
And they don't realize that they're including him when they say anachnu. So it seems that, in other words, that's what Rav Kook seems to be saying. You look at the government looks like it's Jews who are posing as non-Jews. And you're saying us, and you're excluding them, meaning the government. But really, when you say us, it includes those Jews who look like non-Jews in the government. It's like a deeper...
Then I'll pull back to my side, and I'll tell you that's true that we're staying with a government that is Jewish, but it's still nachnu, not nachnu, because the government and the people are not one.
Good.
It cannot
except for one thing. Except for one thing.
Depends on your perspective.
Notwithstanding the problem and the imperfection, the fact of the matter is that if the brothers stood there in the times of Yosef and they were still talking together, Nachnu, missing minus one, that he's still a brother, then that in and of itself is Kedusha V'Tahara. That is progress in and of itself, which ultimately we saw. They all came together. They never in their life expected to be together again with Yosef. And indeed it had its very, very important effects. Both of these psukim indicate, and this is the context of what he's saying, indicate that whenever Bnei Yisrael go against the will of God, they are going to suffer. And parenthetically, I have to indicate, knowing how many things we know of the conversations between Sonnenfeld and Rav Kook, that he viewed the entire Zionist effort. And that's where Naturi Karta began, by the way. He is Mr. Naturi Karta number one. The entire Zionist effort as being Maase Sotam. The devil is dancing here. This is not God's way, and we are the only ones who can keep God's way.
Were meant to apply towards the Zionists.
No question about it. Chalutzim. Okay, they call themselves Chalutzim. He says, remember what the Chalutzim did. Rabbanu Shalom told you not to go. And they went instead. Now,
so Rav Kook is simply saying your attempt to show that this is the case is not correct.
No, is not complete, you see. Is not entirely complete. I don't deny what you are saying. But if you want to use that grammatical structure as some kind of symbolic talk, remember there's another way to use that Nachmu. And it's sitting there by Achei Yosef over there. And that gives you an entirely different perspective. Here is my point, and don't miss it. I'm not here to teach you the Psukim over here. My contention is a unified person. And a person you don't see from Psukim, a person you see in between the lines of the Psukim. That's the issue. Psukim are the building blocks, are the bricks. The personality is the cement that keeps it together. And there wasn't a defect in the masonry of his personality, not one kihuzeh, not one iota. This man was a totally unified personality. Now, I'm not saying that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was a lesser personality. But what I am saying is that here you see the two perspectives. So much so, yeah?
I thought leaving out the Aleph and Anachno would be on Hashem, we without Hashem. A godless.
That's right.
And Rashi says, if the Tzuvim Ruach HaKodesh, Kalu Imahem, Sha'af Hu B'nei Avihim. Say Anachno. Actually, in grammatically,
okay. Take a look at number four.
Oh, now we're talking politics.
All right, now let's talk a little politics to show you what the man could do if only the Rabbanu Shalom in his infinite wisdom had him today. What could have been? Well, you know, maybe wishful thinking. just a word of history. Before the state, all of the so-called business of the Zionist effort was negotiated through so-called Zionist congresses, where on a very flimsy basis they would give representation to individual pockets of so-called Zionists, and if you were X numbers in Kovna, then you had so many delegates that can come to the Zionists, and if you're in Bialystok with Y number of what you call Zionists, then you can come with so many and so forth. And we just went through, or we're about to go through, rather, the 31st Zionist Congress. It doesn't happen every year, but when things get hot and the politics have to be readjusted, they have themselves a Zionist Congress. Ere the 19th Zionist Congress, it was already clear that that things were taking a very dismal turn. On the one hand, Zionists were saying that we have absolutely nothing at all to do with religion. We have a different platform, a different program. This is a political cause. This was Herzl's way of thinking. Political cause, we're not interested in geschäften with religion or whatever. Again, between the lines, I'm telling you, aside from everything else, to be able to sit down with a bunch of European religious Jews, you probably can get a swarm of bees. Well, why the... No, bees do work in concert, and we know that. An anthill of cockroaches to march to your tomb sooner than you can get a religious community over there. This one with his shchita, this one with that shchita, this one with his products and that product.
You didn't invent that here?
No, no. relatively petty nonsense. You hear, I'm choosing my words in relationship to the overall task that had to be accomplished. So on the one hand, the Zionists, the so-called Zionists, they didn't want geschäften. They were able to think in broader terminologies. They're able to think in terms of standing in front of princes and getting a program going. So they wanted nothing to do with religion. But at the same time, in order to once and for all inundate religion, the Zionists decided at one of their congresses that they are going to go into education. Now, once you go into education, you got the control of the next generation and the minds and the hearts of the next generation. Paro Melech Mitzrayim knew that, and that's why he wanted the young ones to remain in Mitzrayim and not go. Because if he could have the influence over the young ones, everything would be okay. He also knew another way to control a community. He didn't want the behemoths to go. He says, take just what you need for Kabbonis, and once you have kashrus, in other words, shkita, under your control, and youth under your control, you need nothing else. You've got the whole Jewish community sewed up. That's all you need. Simple as that. Now, Zionists understood that that at some point in time, they're going to have to get into to education. And this scared the religious community to its very roots. Because Kolzman, as long as you're saying that you're going to be a political action organization, fine, politics is politics. You're going to claim for yourself the right to educate the hearts and the mind of the next generation, then we're in trouble. That's competition already for us that we can't stand. In any event, era of the 19th Congress, there was a petition that was being sent to the 19th Congress concerning kashrus. The old story. You're having congresses, you're having affairs, you're having dinners, and they ain't kosher. Where'd you hear that before? Mm-hmm. What do we have here? B'nai B'rith, the UJM Federation. Ein chadash tachat hashemesh. Absolutely nothing new. Now let's take a look at what's going on here. It was towards the end of his life. It was the era of Shabbos before he died. His masala b'nei Rab Tzvi Yehuda et divrei achad harabanim So his son went ahead and told him about a document that one of the important rabbanim issued, שהתייחס בשלילה לסידור פטיציה גדולה לקונגרס הציוני היוטט. And this Rav felt that it's absolutely insane to go ahead and present a mass petition to the 19th Zionist Congress, whose point was, the point of the petition, l'shem drishat tikuna shel pirtzat hakashrut b'yishuv, to make sure that a resolution is passed at this 19th Congress to bolster kashrus in the new communities, in the new Zionist communities. Halata'an, this Rav felt, sheyesh lihimana mizot, one should not go ahead and present the petition, kidei shelo lahachshiv kol kach et ha-Kongress ha-Tzioni, so as not to give credibility to this Congress that they have the capability of affecting kashrus. Better they should eat treif, because once they eat treif, we know exactly the color of the tiger's skin. You see, you're a bunch of mechalei shablis, you're a chlei talfis, we see it, we know it, you have proven it to us. Why go start asking the policy making organization, the International Zionist Congress, to go ahead and some which way see that there are better conditions for kashrus in the yeshuv? And it meant money. That's basically what it really meant. The end of the last hours of his life, and he had cancer. He was in massive pain. He answered the following: I ask you, how can't you be a Tzioni?
How does he see that the Kosh Baruch Hu is seen from that?
Huh?
How does he get this fact that the Kosh Baruch Hu is a
Tzioni? You tell me.
I don't know, I wouldn't ask if it
No, was. from the Zionist Congress he doesn't see it. Okay? What is he saying? His private language. That's what I'm trying to develop in you. What does he mean? What does he want to say that the Rabbanu Shel Olam is a Tzion?
If someone inspires kashrus even among them, it must be God himself.
If the Rabbanu Shel Olam could come to the Congress, what would the Rabbanu Shel Olam do? Ask the Congress not to work for kashrus, or to work for kashrus? What would he do?
To work for kashrus.
That's what I'm talking about. If the Rabbanu Shel Olam should do it, I shouldn't do it. Now, the Rabbanu Shel Olam stands a chance of being repudiated and telling him to go.
Yes, right.
I stand a chance also.
But you said if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would come to the Congress.
Yeah.
The other forces say HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never come to that Congress.
100%.
So if he wouldn't come there, so let him
That's exactly, again,
to So what did he come to...
Says Rav Kook, I am a shaliach of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, and this door is the shaliach of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, to get people to come back. Mitzvahs Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Chemda, the love of our lives, Eretz Shechin Dua Abo. This is exactly the point. Here you see, again, two total perspectives in this conglomeration of Tzioni and anti-Tzioni, and that's with his last breath he was trying to say that he is so certain that the Rabbanu Shel Olam, this gives the Rabbanu Shel Olam just a little nachas ruach.
In the other forces did not consider the fact mitzvahs yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Wasn't the Talmidim from Vilna Goen who came to Eretz Yisrael, there was no Congress of Tzioni?
100%.
So maybe that's the way they thought it should be done. Because they figured it was going to be done through the Tzionim. It's going to happen what's happened in 1986. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
You know, I unfortunately have missed many of these, so I'm sure the questions I have been asked.
No, don't be sorry.
I'll ask anyway.
This is your opportunity to get on tape for posterity.
One of the reasons, I guess, why I have... I've shifted a long time ago my attitude towards Eretz Yisrael, but having worked with Satmar Hasidim for a few months, I shifted even more. Not with the Satmar Hasidim either. Don't worry. But one of the few fellows, actually, there are two fellows that I can actually have reasonable conversations with, neither of whom are Satmar Hasidim, but will hold very closely for the sheet that they hold. But And they talk about all these sources in the Rambam about how you're not supposed to come back and have a government and do this, this. I mean, do they have all of these legitimate sources which bolster their opinion? Are they also not right? I mean, I agree with them, but are they also not right that maybe it's not being done the right way?
Good. In answer to both of you, there is no question in the world that it's not being done the right way. But here was the issue. What is your alternative, Chaim? Shouldn't be done.
No, like the Talmidim from the Vilna Gaon, it was a slow process, but it was in the right way. No, I'm not saying that's... I'm
the Talmidim
of
the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, they were doing.
So that's exactly what they were referring. Because they're going to ruin whatever we are achieving.
So I hear what you're saying. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld said, all right, let's cut it out. Let the British stay with their mandate. Let the Arabs take over. In 1948, May 15th, 1948, let the Arabs take over and we'll live b'shalom and be able to learn.
Okay. Because to them, the neshama is more important.
I hear what you say. Now, like given the last 40 years, that would have worked since 1948?
I don't know. I'm not a novin, I'm not that smart. But all I know is that someone who works in the government is a groisa macher in the mitzvah, that means he's the feeder from the Likud, his 12-year-old son. When I refused to drink on Tisha B'Av, he says, what's the matter? And I said, I'm fasting, and he didn't know what Tisha B'Av is.
All right. But let me before you get into that, let me just give you a very sharp answer. Go to page 4, selection 4. Okay? And again, you must see this through the mouth, the eyes, and the heart of a totally unified man. Amar HaRav of Cook held that the Pasuk says in Yirmiyahu, Alma of the Haaretz, why was the first Churban? Why did it take place? Al Azva Metorati. The answer is, okay, because we deserted the Torah. Hainu, Bishel Otam Sheinam Tzadikim. What caused the Churban? Bedafki, those who aren't the Tzadikim, those who did not come and observe Torah. Uvechein held Rav Kook, Hein shetzuchim livnota. They are the ones that have to come back and build it. If you make a mess, who's supposed to clean it up? Me? You clean it up. If the Churban came as a result of my ill-fated Avodas Hashem, I am the one that has to turn the hands of time back. The one who does the damage, HaPesha Osa, who HaPesha Hitir, he's the one who has to repair. Now you've got to understand this. This is one of the most unbelievable, it's almost ineffable, you can't even speak of it. How a man views the whole Tahalicha Tshuva, the whole process of Tshuva. If it is Tshuva that we need, and it is, and if it is true of an entire Klal Yisrael, and it is, that's going to do the trick, who are the first ones that should be online? Talmidim of Vilna Gaon? No question about it, they should be. But until we have the concept of tikkun, the Kabbalistic sine qua non, the Ari's tikkun, you don't want Kabbalah, the takein olam b'malchu shakai that we say in Oleinu. The ones who were the ones who went ahead and caused the churban, they are the ones who have to go ahead and be metaken. And that is, you know, and then everything falls into place. You remember that which I quoted a thousand times when he was criticized by Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and others for going out to the kibbutzim and dancing the horror with them. They described on the front pages that he held the hands of the kibbutznikis in the Ganya Bet, I think, it was somewhere there. One of these left-wing kibbutzim, and he danced the horror with them. So they criticized him in with every curse word that you can find, that it was acceptable on a frum paper, on the front page of a frum paper. You know, in the name of Torah, you can say almost anything.
And you know, I see one thing.
Wait a minute, let me finish. And whereupon he answered, they asked him about it. Whereupon he answered, he says, I don't understand. I just learned the Kal V'Chomer from the Rabbanu Shlomo. At Mila time, we say, Atanosin Yodla Poshim, that the Rabbanu Shalom takes the worst Poshea, the worst Rosh of Yisrael, and stretches out a hand and says, Yiminchav Shuta Lekabel Shovim, I'm giving you my right hand here. Come on, I'll pull you out of the mud. Right, says, I learned the Kabbalah coming from the Rabbanu Shalom. He gives one hand. I shouldn't at least give two hands. You were saying?
These are all very rational arguments, and I think most of us can accept them and learn from them. But see, I find that the people that I deal with, which I think are probably representative of those that hold so strongly against the state of Israel, against the secular Zionists, you can't speak to them. You can, absolutely cannot. I am the kind of guy that I want to sit down with someone and say, listen, I try to explain to a guy, you know, you read this paper, they're Yids.
I read it every week.
And I said to him, you know, why do they put on the back of the paper that they're making a tramway in Haifa that's going to run on Shabbos? You don't know that there's still a little Shabbos in Haifa? Why do they have to write that they're going to make a swimming pool that's going to be mixed swimming pool? You don't know that people go mixed swimming in Eretz Yisrael? Or you make a hero out of a guy that runs around and he defaces an advertisement, which we probably wouldn't look twice at walking down the streets in Manhattan, but all right, it's Eretz Yisrael, I understand, it's not serious. And so why inflame the hearts and minds of the people about things that exist already and get them all upset and tight? More importantly than that, you're not even dealing with Zionists anymore. This is, of course, my own opinion, I may be wrong. You're not even dealing with people who are Zionists. They're not the same people that got malaria and worked 20 hours a day and that, even though they weren't from, they really died for the Jewish people. Doesn't mean that I praise their departure from Yiddishkeit. But still, they believe in something. That's not the same clientele you're dealing with today. You're dealing with people who want designer jeans, they want to go to America, they want to have a good time, they're tired already of being surrounded by the enemy. You have to reach out to the Ahava. You have to educate the people. People have to go there. They have to vote. They have to take part in the process. You don't like it, it's not perfect. Well, then lose me. You can make it better. But
it's turning like a dancer.
Right, what are you
doing?
The problem
it
is, you know, you make all these points, A, B, C, and D. Now, it sounds great to me, and it sounds rational, but you say it, and they've got all kinds of things they can spout off. I'm bumming, flipping, this and that, and you're back to nothing. As if you wasted my entire breath.
You see, but it isn't a waste. You're on in a second. It isn't a waste if I can only reinforce in your mind this new kind of thinking. That when you look at a Rambam, you can look at the lines. But if you want to look between the lines of the Rambam, you have to look at the people who are learning it and what their personality wants to derive from it. The private language. And what I'm trying to get you to understand is the private language of Rav Kook.
What the Reed writes, I'm not advocating for Reeds. So let's take it with them. But what he brings up, Haifa, the train, or Chazer, whatever they do. They bring up plenty of that. Not simply that Shabbos, I had to eat at my home because my parents were at my home.
The Jewish National Enquirer.
Right, I read it every week.
It's the same way, like I would criticize the Knesset and things like that. It has nothing to do with Tzionim and Natzionim. For the Yid, it's a matter of halacha. So you should understand the Yid why it's writing. And besides, he could congregate around him his readership by showing a point, what's his direction. Unlike other newspapers who have no directions. Now what you said about the Chalutzim, you said it was quite reference for the Chalutzim, that they did so much to sacrifice their life. Unfortunately, Chalutzim did not do it for the love of Chalutziyut as much as they were lost. They did not find themselves among the Pshtiblach, among the Hasidim, or among the Mesnagdim. They rebelled against it. They had nothing else. And there comes the Chalutziyut, something which gave them some spirit. But unfortunately, the spirit was not taught as much as
they were. Rebellion.
Very few
were very devoted, with a direction towards, as not as much as running away from. What I mean to say, running away from the Yiddishkeit, from everything, their direction was towards. They did not care about that. There was Ben Gurion. They were the leaders of that caliber. They were, but the majority of the Yud, the Chalutzim, who came in and then Torah,
They were just looking for something because they ran away from something.
And look what they did in running away, in their escape. But just like Columbia University in the 60s when they burned Columbia. Just like in the 60s when they burned the draft cards. Just like in the 60s when they burned downtown here, Monroe Street and Newark. Right? Look at the difference.
Did anything less from the 60s revolution?
Absolutely nothing. What do I have from those chalutzim, those tetniates? All right? My kids were able to daven at the Kotel and learn in Yerushalayim, and I slept all night. My congregation, bis 120 years, every single one gave me a sabbatical 11 years ago because they didn't know whether it was Milchiks or Fleishiks, and I was in Yerushalayim to make a Siyam HaShas because of those chalutzim.
Well, if there would be no chalutzim, you couldn't have gone to the Kotel.
In my day, who ever thought of going to the Kotel?
As a matter of fact,
for
19 years, we couldn't go to the Kotel because of the Tzionim, because of the chalutzim. For 90 years we had no access to the Kotel.
We have no access to the Kotel. Only because of the chalutzim.
Well, because of the creation of a different state.
Who was standing there with God, keeping you from going to the Kotel? The chalutzim or the Arabs?
I don't know.
It's two different things. We'll go a little further. Look, I'm trying to understand Rav Chaim Zonnfeld the way he thinks.
Okay.
I'm trying to understand. If you would go back, because I have an uncle who lives in Yerushalayim, and he came to Yerushalayim, how old is he? He must be in the 60s, he came there as a boy. And he lived in the Daltashtut. And he lived by the coast all the time. And he didn't need a chalutzim to protect him to go to the coast. Of course, there was a program, Chevron. There was those things that were always like that.
Yeah, my father, so the Gesundheitsstaat signed until 101, he was supposed to be one of those.
In Chevron?
Last minute, his father convinced him.
Who's this, your father?
My father had a friend, Chavrusa, with whom he learned on the east side here. They both wanted to go to Hebron. Chavrusa went and was one of those whose masks. My father remained here.
Do you think we would have less Hebron massacres if we had not a Jewish state?
I don't know about those things. Probably would have other massacres. Right now there isn't killing in other forms. If we will take all the wars that we have combined and all the terrorist action, which up to now have killed already 20,000 Jews, I don't think 20,000 Jews would have been killed with massacres and all those.
No,
I don't think even a fraction of that would have killed.
They'd still have pogroms in Europe then.
It's very likely.
I mean,
it's very likely. But what are the Tzionim doing now? Now we're going to lose it anyway.
All you have to do is look at 2,000 years of European history where the Jews are running.
How many were killed? I mean, in the last 200 years in pogroms.
In the last what?
In the last 200 years.
Oh, 6 million.
Besides 6 million, that wasn't anything to do with that. That's to do with all well. Not with programs. That has to do already with an organized.
Give a number. How many?
I would estimate. We could run any more than six, up to 1,000 for programs.
In the last 200 years,
yes.
1,000 people.
Yes.
200?
Last two centuries.
Yes, so that's 1,000.
That's not correct.
I don't think even that 1,000. I think it less than that.
Minsky with the 1600s.
Well, in 1905, there was something.
1905?
There was a revolution. There was a revolution.
Kishinev.
Golda Meir wasn't Kishinev.
Maximum. A couple hundred. Maximum. The man is right. But he doesn't tell you what the population figures were then. You see. You have to establish that. We say Akina. That's in our edition on Tisha B'Av for Beaupark and York.
Yeah.
Okay? Right. You know how many were killed?
That was in 1050. That was
okay? You know how many were killed? 31 people. The whole town was like that, 31 people. There are 31 Jews, more than 31 Jews living on this one street. You see, nonetheless, it's in relationship to the population, it is a disaster. I hear what you're saying. And the only answer that I have is to show you that Rav Kook diametrically opposed all of this thinking because he was working with a different set of equations. Take a look on page 4. Number 3. Shalu et ha'av, they asked him, why do you spend so much time with these sinners? Mipnei ma'ehu chas al zmano b'sichot aruchot im anashim shelachaku mitorah mitzvot. There are a bunch of good for nothings. If I can get one of them just to think l'hanhig mikbach kasher bebeito, that he should have a kosher kitchen with two sets of dishes, how is that kedai, my time is worth it. One.
Sounds a little bit like NCSY.
What are you talking about, a little bit like NCSY?
Or Lubavitch,
I hate to tell you, this guy knew Rav Kook when he was in NCSY. That's the problem.
You knew Rav Kook personally?
I knew his Torah. How can I know Rav Kook? I was born in 39, he died in what? In 33.
Wow.
Okay? All of NCSY and all of my work those 10 years, 493,000 miles is based on that. If it wouldn't have been for the understanding and ability to understand what this man is saying. Take a look at number 6. Rav nifgash im echad ha-chavirim ha-pilim shebikibutz smoli yadua. A left-wing known kibbutz, and one of the chavirim of the kibbutz met with Rav Kook, sheratzu le'efot sham b'chametz v'pesach. In this kibbutz, they wanted to have chametz on Pesach. Tchilat ha-pgisha amar lo ha-rav, so Rav Kook, obviously wanting to see that this doesn't happen, he says to him, I want you to know, at this meeting, gentlemen, there's only one ground rule. Kan omrim rak et ha-emet. At this table, only truth will be spoken. Kishenisa askan lasbir et ma'aseyim. And when this chevroman from the kibbutz tried to explain what he was doing, Bazeh Shehem Lo Datiyim, and his whole rationale was, we are not religious. He cut him off right on the spot and said, Hare Amalti Lecha, you forgot the ground rule. Kan Omrim Rak Et Ha'emet. There's only truth here. You idiot, what are you talking about? You are not religious. Do you know what kind of a holy neshama you are? Rak Ha'emet. That's the point. There is no such thing as a Jew who is not religious. Doesn't exist. These are mutually exclusive terminologies. I just heard this from Rabbi Teitz the Younger about his father, who many, many years ago was in Paris. And in Paris, they had restaurants that were open on Shabbos to accommodate the crowd, but it wasn't a Mechal Shabbos kind of an operation. It was run. Shabbos hotels that you can do it. You make your arrangements before, but there you had restaurants. A couple, a family drives up, he says, gets out of a car, comes in to the restaurant, there's a husband, wife, and children. They get up to make Kiddush, they go to wash, they make hamotzi, they sing zmiris, they bench, and they go out, and they get into the car, and they drive away. Now, at first he said, I didn't know what to think of it. And he realized, the only way you can explain this, nope, so you're a Mechal Shabbos, good. That means that you're not Mechayev, that you're not obligated to wash and make Kiddush and bench? What's it to talk about? But this perspective is quintessential, the difference between a Reb Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld, in other words, the so-called black hat world that we have today, and Rav Kook. With the exception of none other than Lubavitch. Simple as that. Who ever said that a Mechal Shabbos is you are allowed to go ahead and lead down the road until he goes and does other averus? What kind of chutzpah is this? And a Jew who comes to shul and is saying kodesh, 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 and kadesh shimcha ba'olam, ayem ekom kevodo, that's a Mechal Shabbos? By definition, a Mechal Shabbos is one who wants to prove that there is no Ribbono Shel Olam in this world. Now, this is the gray area, Bachaschalta de Gula. These are the Chevle Leido. This is the insanity that we live with. But to be able to sort out the insanity and make some kind of rational thought of it, so as to be able to have a workable philosophy how to approach this Wildkeit that we've never had, at least in the last 3,700 years, it's never been this way as it's been in the last 200. Rav Kook was able to do it, was able to see it because of this unified personality. What are you talking about here? You're not from, that's why you can go ahead and you can bake chametz on Pesach? And let's bring it down to today, the same problem that we have today.
if a Jew who is a Trefniak wants to give money for a Torah project, do you take it or you don't take it? So there are those who will say, Chassidim will say you don't take it. You don't take it. There has to be a sense of integrity of Kiddush and Torah. And there are those who say, what are you talking about? So you mizakas a rabbin from this money, this taking of the money, I may be able to get him to come in and sit down in the Beis Medrash and learn a little, and who knows what's going to be with his children and children's children.
This is a classic problem. I'm dealing with this in the bathroom because I'm a month behind here. You know, as to whether you take money, do you take money from Goyim and continue it? Meshur dealt with this, Major Barber. You know, that's a whole machloket here as to whether you take from an arms manufacturer. And he says, I'll give you money for your peace movement. You know, you justify me, and I'll give you the money. You know, I mean...
So you look at motivation. You look at motives, as without question. But a Jew who doesn't live... Who was it who told me? A massive magnate. Wasn't it you, Jerry? With what's his name?
So
tell it, the original.
Shall I mention his name? Or?
Unless it's confident, unless it was told to you in confidence. But it doesn't matter what name it is.
I won't mention his name, but there is a gentleman who sponsored one of the weddings that Bris Avraham ran for 22 couples. He paid for the wedding.
Foster. The first one, the very first.
I mean, you're talking in the area of $50,000 or $60,000 that he financed, and he has done all sorts of good deeds for Bris Avraham in this way. And he said to me, "But he himself and his family is lost. There's no hope for them. But they can do what they can for the Jewish people." Mm. I forget whether he said that his children were just not from, or that they had intermarried.
He was
not
Jewish.
No,
he's Jewish. His wife is Jewish. This somehow. Well, Rabbi Kudelsky has a way of talking to people and getting at something. I don't know how. I don't know how he goes about it. And they just decided this is what they have to do, and this is the organization they're going to contribute to. And sometimes this kind of mentality just says, well, this is, you know, I'm paying for it. I'm paying for it. I'm paying X amount of money up until this point.
Paint the scenario in Olam Haba. When Lachamei Avesim Shana, this Mechal Shabbos and Ochel Treifus is going to stand, you know, and give din v'cheshvan like all of us. What do you think? This is going to be a zechus to him?
We mean, sure it's going to be a zechus.
I can, if I had to write a play...
We don't believe in exclusively you're either a sinner or you're this. It doesn't work that
way. If I had to write a play, there would be two things that would come to my mind. The Rabbani Shalom saying, Yadati b'ni Yadati. I know what went on with you, my child. I know what went on. Or Kone Odom Es Olamo B'Shoachas.
That's why Rabbi cried.
No.
Because how many Olamos we don't buy and we have a chance.
And look what he did buy. And I'm going to tell this Mechal Shabbos, this Ochel Treifus, you're not going to do it. But you don't understand. The closest thing to this kind of thinking, let's call it Cookian thinking, all right? Make believe you're in a university, right? That's you have to talk. Fancy philosophy, Joel knows it. You know? Cookian thought. Chaim Potok was sitting here, that's what he would say, without the yarmulke. The closest thing that you have, aside from what's in the yeshiva there, is none other than the Bat Shem. No two ways about it. Take a look at number 7.
Rabbi Kanelsky said that, maybe it happened last year too, that the week following the wedding this year, he was inundated with phone calls. That means maybe 8 of people who wanted him to kosher their kitchen and to do this and to do that and how to be out of nowhere.
That's it.
Do you think... I mean, to give the flip side of this again, some of this thing that with...
Rav Shachtin, he was talking about the Babish, the thing with Rav Shachtin and Yisrael, so it really bothered me. This reaction to, to Lubavitch having people learn Rambam. I mean, is this the flip side of this kind of thinking?
Certainly. Rav Shach is a direct descendant of the Vilna Gaon.
I mean, is there is there some sort of other rational explanation for that?
There is a rational explanation, but what I am saying to you, Joel, is that you must view this in one context only, in the context of personality, and be able to understand these two models of thinking. Like, if you were to go through all Beis Hillel and all Beis Shammai, we'd be able to come up with a personality construct. Okay? That's how much material that we have that would make it valid. This new branch of history and psychology of psychoanalysis called psychohistory. Be able to reconstruct the mind some which way based on historical realities. Now we can take these two realities called a Rav Kook type of thinking, which is not indigenous to Rav Kook. It was Baal Shem Tov. What's there to talk about? It was Baal Shem Tov.
I don't understand what the other side is.
That's sort of my question. I don't understand how someone can kind of like.
You mean Rav Shach?
Yeah. What can be the rational objection to people sitting down and learning Rambam?
He blasted the Lubavitch Rebbe's effort for that.
Yeah.
What was the reason?
No.
The rational. Yes, he did.
No, I mean, I'm wrong.
Wait a minute. So the rationale is as follows: Lo kol arutze mitolas Hashem mitol. Not everyone who wants to come and say Yud Kei Vov Kei is allowed to go ahead and do it. The same way, Joel, the same way that Rav Shach is going to say that not everyone sits down and learns Zohar. That is the whole. That's the whole beef against Lubavitch. They took Chassidus out of the realm of shtick and put it squarely in the center realm of Torah learning. That's the point. Whereas Rav Shach should have made a Daf Yomi for the Rambam. Didn't. Lubavitch Rebbe did. But then again, the one who made a Daf Yomi wasn't a Misnagad either. Tamar Shapiro were the worst father king of the Blin. He was a Chosin.
Well, he was a square or good in it. But that was a little...
He was more a Chosin than a Misnagad. See, they were activists.
So
now you go ahead and you sit down and teach. This is look.
Is it the Beit Shammai concept?
In a sense, but not entirely. Definitely in a sense. But do you go ahead and you teach college kids who know absolutely nothing of a difference between an aleph and a beis or a pasuk chumash? You go ahead and you sit down and teach them Kabbalah.
Are you seriously asking me?
Rav Shach will say lunacy, and Lubavitch Rebbe will say pnimius, and let's get him going. You know, like microwave Judaism. You know what microwave Judaism is? You start cooking from the inside out. When Rav Shach wants to go into the oven, and you bake from the outside in. Simple as that. Why shouldn't I give a person pnimius as the other approach? And get to that heart and flame the nuclear energy that is there, guaranteed it's there, and let it do its job. As Lubavitch.
These are two models.
But the comparisons the rabbis bring from Rambam to Zohar and Kabbalah, this is two different worlds. The only way I could understand Rav Shach, which by the way I happen to know personally, he mediated an argument I had with Rav Teretz in Magdiel. It was a anyway, v'negetz kenaf kavod, the verse in Yeshayahu, the tithing guy, he reaches old age, disappears, but kuvet something, you can't overcome it. It's impossible to overcome it. And I think Rav Shach, I think he sees himself as the good Olador, and he's a little bit against the fact that he didn't metak is something that was so successful.
Well, you are telling me something which I'm trying to get you to understand. If instead of looking at the words and looking in between
the words, I thought the rabbi was telling you because the Rambam is so sophisticated. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think Rambam is much more easier to learn than any Gemara.
You see, but I must have. You see, when I look for Kovid, you're talking to an expert.
Well, but you're not in the stage where
I'm getting older. I'm getting older, and I'm more Kovid all the time. Hey, whenever I see, there's no question. When a person demands Kovid, it has to be done in such a way that if pushed to the wall, he can show you a pasuk or a halacha. Because if he's just going to say it's because I'm getting older and I want Kovid, he'll lose his whole power base instantly.
The rabbi knows that people don't demand COVID in such a way. Okay. Some demand COVID by saying, "Ich will nicht COVID." That's how demands COVID.
The entire generation, the entire area of Torah Yiddishkeit is split now into two. Chassidim in the Ger, whatever that is, and Rav Shach in the Lidlitvish world, the Yeshivish world. This is nothing more than a replay of 75 years ago when Agudas Yisrael was founded. Nothing more than a replay. The only slight difference is that in 1907, at the beginning, there was a third element. There was the Lithuanian yeshivas, there was the Hasidic of Poland, and there were the Germans. The Germans don't exist today. They don't count. They're gone. But it's the two power plays that we've had for 70 years. It's the same thing. All right, so could we please come back to Rav Kook once more in another, on page 4, number 7.